back to Hertz Ag Talk. I'm your host, Troy Kazire, with Hertz Farm Management here in Geneseo, Illinois. And we've got a return guest today, Nick Sider, who is a research assistant professor of field crop entomology at the University of Illinois. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Why don't we, I know we've talked to you before, but it's been a while. Why don't you kind of remind us, you know, what it is your, kind of what your role and responsibilities are there at the university, and a little bit about your background too, if you don't mind.
Yeah, certainly. So I'm an extension specialist in field crop entomology. And what that means, my role is focused around developing pest management recommendations for field crops in Illinois. And of course, for us, that's primarily corn and soybean. I have responsibilities for wheat as well, and forage crops, but we don't get into as many issues with insects in wheat as we do in corn and soybean, at least not in Illinois. And so that's where I spend most of my time. In terms of my background, I'm an entomologist by training. Got a PhD in entomology from Clemson down in South Carolina. And then I also worked as an extension entomologist in Arkansas for 3.5 years and, you know, worked on insect pest management in cotton, soybean, grain sorghum, corn, so a variety of crops down there.
All right. Well, appreciate you taking the time to visit with us today and share your insight. And, I think why don't we start off with kind of the it's kind of the big one that we worry about every year throughout the Corn Belt, and that is corn rootworm. And so I'll just kind of open it up to you. What are you seeing? What are you hearing? You know, I don't know if I assume you've got information handy as to kind of what beetle counts were last year and what you were seeing and kind of what you expect.
Yeah, certainly. And so when we look at the beetle counts first, it was kind of interesting. Our beetle counts were a bit lower last year in 2022, certainly than they were in 2021. And that was after several years where they had kind of crept up every year. But what really continues to be interesting to us is that with those beetle counts, especially north of I-80, where most of our rootworm problems are now, we're seeing a lot of northern corn rootworms, and in fact, in most of our problem fields, like when we go out to a problem field where we get damage in pyramided corn, most of the time, there's a pretty healthy mix of northern corn rootworm and western corn rootworm, or even in several cases, there's more northerns in there than westerns. And what's interesting about that to us is, you know, for many years, northern corn rootworm had become almost like a curiosity in Illinois. It's not something we thought about very much, where western corn rootworm was really the dominant species, and both in terms of economics and in terms of just beetle numbers. So it's kind of an interesting rebound for that species. Of course, with both species, we have resistance to BT traits, and we have resistance documented at least in some areas to all four BT traits with both species. So really an insect that's becoming more and more difficult for us to control.
So what, we probably don't really know for sure, but what are your thoughts on what has caused that shift? Because anecdotally, I've certainly seen a lot more northern corn rootworm beetles out in the fields. What do you think has kind of pushed that shift?
Well, it's certainly related, at least in part, to northern corn rootworm's ability to overcome pyramided BT traits. So one thing to note about northern corn rootworm in particular, so there's, you know, the CRY 34-35 trait, and there's the three, what we call the CRY 3 traits, and that's like mm-hmm. the yield guard, the 3BB1, and the AgriSure trait, and the Duracade trait. Well, that CRY 34-35, which is very effective against western corn rootworm, it's actually less effective against northern corn rootworm. And that's not a not a resistance thing, though we do have resistance confirmed in northern quadrupworm to that trait. But just on day one, it was not as effective against northern as it was against western. And so what may be happening is that as northern corn rootworm is overcoming those other traits, they're able to overcome the pyramid a little bit faster than western can. And that might give them a bit of a competitive advantage. And what's really interesting about this to me as an entomologist, so usually if you have those two insects on the same plant, all other things being equal, and there's good conditions for both, western corn rootworm will actually outcompete northern corn rootworm, and that's why it's been the dominant species in Illinois for so long. And so it might be that as northern overcomes these traits, it gets a little bit of that advantage back if it's able to do so faster, at least with some trait packages, than western corn rootworm.
Well, and as we so. I guess a question that comes to mind as we think about the different ways that these insects, you know, Mother Nature helps them get around our efforts to control them. As you're seeing an increase in the northern corn rootworm species, are you also seeing an increase in the extended diapause variant of that particular beetle?
That's a really good question, and it's a hard one to get at. I was actually emailing with one of my colleagues, Joe Spencer, here at the Natural History Survey, about what we can do to look at extended diapause in northern corn rootworm. You know, anecdotally, we've had some reports of first-year corn damage. Not that many, but we've had some reports of that. And really those reports, you know, as opposed to coming from like East Central Illinois, where like the variant western corn rootworm has been dominant, or had been, you know, pretty prevalent in the past. Those reports of first year corn are coming from areas, kind of the same areas we're having problems in continuous corn, where there's high populations of northerns. Unfortunately, extended diapause is a difficult trait to look at. And we don't have a great handle on what percent of the northern corn rootworm population in Illinois right now goes through that extended diapause trait. It's something we want to look at, and it's kind of a high priority for us. But, you know, as you might imagine, it takes several years of documenting this to be able to really recognize what's going on out in the field.
Sure.
We don't have a great handle on it just yet, but we would like to.
And I probably should, just to make sure, I'm sure most people listening are aware of what we're talking about exactly, but just to make sure everybody's on the same page, when we talk about extended diapause, we're talking about a beetle that lays eggs that essentially lay dormant for a year or even more, I think in some cases. And so the, you know, rotating away from corn to soybeans or whatever for a year, just isn't an effective control anymore, because the eggs simply don't hatch that year, and then when you go back to corn, they hatch. And it's mostly been up in the sort of southern Wisconsin, right, southern Minnesota, some of those areas where we've seen higher numbers of those typically, correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Northern Illinois is right in there with them.
Okay. And, you know, you mentioned resistance. There is field resistance out there now to all the BT traits. Has there been any documented field resistance to the new RNAi traits up to this point?
Not here in Illinois. So what they've been able to do with the RNAi is collect survivors from the field and develop a resistant colony in the lab in fairly short order. So the potential for resistance is there. It wouldn't be something we would expect to be all that widespread in the field right now. What we do see with RNAi, it's a little slower acting than BT, and that's one of the reasons that it's paired with BT traits when it's released. And so what you can see sometimes with RNAi even when it's effective, if those BT proteins are compromised, you'll get some pruning on there. You might get extremely low or even no adult survival, but you'll get some pruning on those roots if those BT traits are compromised. And so that's something we kind of expect to see, especially if it's released into, you know, some fields that have a problem. You're probably going to see a little bit of feeding on those roots, assuming that it's a rootworm population that is surviving fairly well on BT proteins.
So the other thing that, you know, a lot of guys wonder about, you know, this time of year as we head into a new season is, you know, was there any, was winter kill a factor? And I, you know, I'll kind of defer to you. You're obviously the expert here. I seem to recall that I've heard that really winter kill is not much of a factor with corn rootworm. They lay their eggs deep enough that it's pretty difficult to get the soil cold enough, long enough to really cause egg mortality. Is that true, or am I off base there?
Yeah, that's pretty true for Illinois. So where we talk about winter mortality having a big effect on the population, that's really when you get up into like the Dakotas. Okay. So they'll tell you, like, when they have a particularly bad winter, it favors northern corn rootworm and sort of suppresses western. For us, it's pretty uncommon for that to be a big issue with corn rootworm, and, you know, especially this past winter, which was barely, for us, barely a winter at all, it seemed like. I mean, there were times where it got pretty cold, but compared to your average Illinois winter, I wouldn't expect it to have had much of an impact.
Sure.
At all.
Now, are you doing any kind of trapping program around corn rootworm this year?
Yeah, and for the last couple of years, and this is kind of a regional project, our colleagues over at Iowa State are sort of coordinating it, but we'll send out sticky traps to anybody who's willing to put them out. If you're willing to put those traps out, a row of four of them in a field, it can be continuous corn field, it can be a soybean field that's going to be rotated into corn, whatever you want. If you're willing to send us the data, we'll send you the traps. And we've had several of these go out in Illinois each of the last couple of years with some success. I don't know if we had 30 fields last year or something like that. It's a little hard to keep track of them. And then there's folks all over the north central U.S. who are doing this. And what we especially like to do with this is it gives us an idea of where that pressure is most intense. And usually that's something we already have a fairly good handle on. But it also helps us to document the changes in this rootworm population with northern corn rootworm in particular, you know, helps us to document that trend, helps us to see in particular where that insect is getting a foothold. And so if that's something you're interested in, you know, shoot me an email, NSEITER@illinois.edu, and we'll get you set up with some sticky traps.
Great. Good to know. Anything else on corn rootworm that we really haven't touched on yet, Nick?
I think we've touched the main things. You know, one thing that's really important as a farmer when we're talking about corn rootworm and when we're talking about how these traits are performing, really helps to go out and dig up a few roots, maybe from each technology, each control tactic that you're using, and see what you've got going on below the ground. If you have the ability to do that, I highly recommend it. Sometimes we get, you know, caught up in the idea that if the corn stayed up, like if it didn't fall over, I didn't have a problem. And for that reason, these resistance issues can sort of go hidden until they really come to a head and you have a really serious issue. To where you're actually having corn fall over. We want to know that we're headed in that direction before we get there so that we can change up what we're doing, mix in some variety, mix in some rotation into that field, into that area. to help to reduce the selection pressure on these traits.
Yeah, and so when we that's great advice. I think, you know, nobody likes doing it, but I think it's well no. worth the time to go out and dig a few root balls and see what you've got going on. You know, when you think about the timing of doing that, right? We're, you know, kind of the rule of thumb is hatch is well underway when we start seeing lightning bugs. Yep. And so when we start to see meaningful feeding and we want to be digging root balls, what kind of just as we're going into tassel, or what timing do you recommend there?
Yeah, that's about right. If you can do it just before tassel, you'll avoid getting covered in pollen while you do it. But you want to get as much size on that root mass as you can before you do it. We usually start our evaluations like second week of July, and I like to do them, you know, either right before or right after tassel. Somewhere in there, but it's not all that sensitive to the time that you do it. So it's one of those things where if you get delayed a week or so, it's not a huge deal.
Yeah. And understand too, it's important to remember if you wait too long, especially if you've got a fair amount of pruning, you get a lot of root regrowth, a lot of small, you know, hairy roots that can really make it difficult to see the damage and make it difficult to wash the, you know, get the soil off of the root balls too. So you want to wait until you've got good feeding, but don't wait too long or it can be even more of a pain than it is already.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I get, we're so used to cutting through regrowth that it doesn't bother us as much, but it does make that a pain. And then the other thing, like if you wait, you know, occasionally folks will wait till the very end of the season. And as that root starts to deteriorate a little bit, it becomes a lot harder to distinguish rootworm damage from other sorts of damage.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, another insect we're thinking about this time of year, I think it's about time, the time when we start to see black cutworm moth flights. We just had a couple of pretty significant storm systems go through the area, and a lot of times those end up, you know, lifting those moths up in the air and carrying them fairly long distances. So what are you hearing on the black cutworm front?
Yeah, and so got a report from my colleagues over in Indiana at Purdue University this morning that, you know, their first week of black cutworm moth trapping, like this is pretty early for black cutworms to really be active. They had some pretty high counts in some areas that they attributed, and I think rightly, to the recent storms that came through. And really that line of storms, it kind of came out of the southwestern U.S., sort of out of Texas and Oklahoma and areas like that where that insect is active over a longer period of time. And so when we get a system like that early, it can bring those moths in early and give them a chance to get established early. And so that's something we want to look out for, because really for us, it's a migratory insect. So the development of that insect is related to how soon the moths arrive. So since they're here early, they can get some size on them early. And you'll recall with black cutworm, it's once it reaches that fourth instar, so once it gets to be about a half or three quarters of an inch long, that's where it's capable of causing that cutting damage to corn in particular, which is what we really get concerned about. The other thing, excuse me, about those moths arriving early is what they're really attracted to. It's not going to be a nice clean, burned down field with very little vegetation in it. It's not even going to be a field of seedling corn that's otherwise clean. Where those moths really want to lay their eggs is in some of our winter annual weeds, things like chickweed and shepherd's purse, that, you know, right now in early April might be pretty hairy in some of the fields that we have out there. And so usually our worst situations with black cutworm are when you have a field like that where you have a lot of winter annual weeds and then the burn down application gets delayed. So you end up planting into something that, you know, has a fairly significant weed issue. And while you'll be able to kill those weeds pretty effectively with a herbicide, probably, As you're doing that, those larvae are going to need something to feed on, and they're going to crawl over to those corn plants in particular. They'll do this to soybean too, but we see it a lot more often in corn. And that's where they can cause that cutting damage that leads to stand loss.
And what about cover crops? Are there any particular cover crop species that they're more attracted to, or is they just looking for green vegetation in general?
Yeah, with cutworms, and one thing that's been interesting, we've had a few reports over the last few years of variegated cutworms hitting some very high numbers in fields that have been planted to like a clover cover crop. We don't do a lot of clover in Illinois, it doesn't seem like, but you get some of it here and there as a cover. And there's been a few cases where you've had kind of some devastation to stand. I remember one field of soybean in particular getting a report that it had been just really hammered by variegated cutworm following that. And then, you know, the more common cover crop that we see in Illinois is cereal rye, right? That's the one that probably we plant more than any other, cereal rye or another winter grain, winter wheat, that kind of thing. And in that, we don't see black cutworm as often. What we'll see more commonly is true armyworm. Which is similar in a lot of ways, just like black cutworm. You know, it's a migratory species. The moths are flying in from the southern U.S., and they're attracted to something other than the main crop, unless the main crop is wheat. They're very attracted to wheat. And so when you have those grassy-type cover crops, you're more likely to see an issue from armyworm than you are from black cutworm.
So, you know, obviously clean fields, keeping the weeds out of them, you know, timely termination of cover crop. Other management tactics are remind me about BT traits. Are there any BT traits that provide effective control of black cutworm?
Yeah, and so the VIP3A trait in particular does a pretty good job on that one. Cry1F, I believe, still does a decent job on black cutworm. Most of the corn borer traits are just kind of sort of okay. But since those traits have been introduced, our black cutworm issues in general seem to be a lot smaller than they used to be. So whether that's from a little bit of suppression over a wide area, you know, kind of that population reduction effect that we sometimes see. And then with armyworm, it's really just the VIP3A protein that provides effective control of that insect.
Okay. And any, you know, VIP done a pretty effective job on earworm as well. Any field resistance issues popping up there on VIP?
Oh, with the earworm, absolutely. Yeah. Earworms are, well, I should back up. Earworms, they become quite resistant to all of the BT traits except for VIP. VIP's still holding strong with that. We've heard of a few blips in the southern U.S. over the last few years. Nothing in Illinois yet. So we're concerned because of the pressure that's on that one trait, because with earworm, it's really the only one anymore that's providing all that much control in a lot of cases. But yeah, the VIP protein's still working fairly well on that insect. And the other thing that works very well for us with corn earworm, if we're talking about field corn, is planting date. And so usually what we see in years where we're able to get planted early, we typically don't see as many issues, especially in northern Illinois with corn earworm. But we get a year like 2019 where we plant very late, and all of a sudden that injury jumps out at us. Because, yeah, it can be pretty widespread in a late planted field in particular.
And you mentioned the South as being kind of the epicenter of some of those issues. A lot of that has to do with basically the cotton bollworm and corn earworm are the same, essentially the same species, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's actually a really interesting situation for them because most of their selection happens in corn. So they'll have corn, and you know, they're in South Arkansas. They've probably been planting corn for a few weeks now. They'll have corn coming off beginning in August, if it's a good year. And so those earworms, that first generation of earworm down there, might be coming off of corn in July and then pupating and going straight into cotton. And it's a much bigger pest in cotton than it is in corn. You know, in corn, we get quality issues. We get the opportunities for ear rots to develop. We don't get a lot of, you know, weight loss, bushel loss, that kind of thing. We do get some quality loss. But in cotton, it's a nightmare. It's a terrible pest in that crop because it's just direct damage to the fruiting structure of that crop. And with cotton, you know, it's a little different from corn and soybean. Like corn and soybean, they get stressed out, and their response is to pour resources into the seed. Cotton's a perennial plant that we grow as an annual. And so when that cotton plant gets stressed out, its first response is to drop its fruit and save itself. So you get a little bit of damage to that fruit, and it'll start shedding them. And then with bollworm, you have direct damage to the fruiting structure. They'll feed on the flower buds, the squares, the blooms. They'll feed on the bolls themselves. You can get some really serious damage from that insect.
That's interesting. I didn't necessarily realize that. And of course, you know, and back to the resistance issue, I mean, we've got two different crops, but we're, you know, in large part relying on the exact same traits in both of those crops to try to control it. And so they're getting pretty heavy selection exposure.
Yeah, absolutely. And for them in cotton right now, VIP is really, it's the only trait that's still performing for them. So they have a strong vested interest in maintaining susceptibility to that trait. For us, you know, obviously we want to keep it around as well. We certainly don't want to lose it. But we don't have the sense of urgency that they do. And then of course, as a migratory pest, what's interesting about it for us, you know, we talk about stewardship a lot with insects like corn rootworm and European corn borer that overwinter here. But with an insect like corn earworm, we really just, whatever resistance problems we have in Illinois, we kind of inherit whatever happened down in the southern U.S. where they overwinter. So we don't necessarily have a lot of control over the situation here. Not that I would say they have a ton of control over what this particular insect does. But you won't hear as much about stewardship of traits in our geography with corn earworm, not because stewardship isn't important, but because they don't overwinter here. And so whatever selection happens here tends to be more of a dead end.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great point. Absolutely. So, you know, we're fortunate up until this point that we haven't really had to deal with this pest here in Illinois, but as we get out, you know, west of the Mississippi River and get into Iowa, you know, I think Nebraska as well, they've been dealing with this kind of relatively new pest, soybean gall midge. I know it's not a huge focus of yours, you know, due to being here in Illinois, but what are you hearing on that front, and what do we know? We still see an expansion of that territory, and what are we needing to be watching for?
Okay, so the good news on soybean gall midge, and remember, that's a really interesting situation. That's an insect that's actually, we don't know if it's invasive or not because it's new to science. Like when they found it in soybean in Nebraska, that was the first time anyone had found it anywhere. And that's not something that happens very often where something that feeds on a crop like soybean is unknown. And so what's happened, they've found this insect in a lot of new counties over the last few years. What they haven't found an expansion of is the area where it's really causing substantial damage. And that remains primarily sort of along the eastern border of Nebraska and the western border of Iowa. And as it's been explained to me, what they're probably just becoming a lot better at finding it, you know, at finding this insect that previously no one knew existed, so nobody knew to look for it. So it doesn't seem like it's spreading very fast, even though they found it in some new areas. The closest they found it to Illinois is still several hundred miles away. Doesn't mean that it might not be here at very low levels, but it's not been confirmed in Illinois. We did a fairly extensive survey looking for it in Illinois last year. Excuse me. Didn't find it, which is good. That it's one of those surveys where we're really hoping to look as hard for it as we possibly can and still not find it. And that's what we did last year. Actually conducted a couple of different surveys. So Kelly Estes, who does our statewide insect pest survey, she looked for it in, I think it was like 310 fields, something like that, all over Illinois. And then I did a survey that was more focused on kind of the northwestern border of Illinois in the river valley, which is where our colleagues have indicated to us that if it were to be found here, based on habitat, based on proximity to previous finds, that's probably where it would be. So we sampled that area a little more intensively and didn't find it there either. The bad news on gall midge is they've had a hard time controlling it. You know, they've had a hard time finding very effective control measures where they're at. So the adults are very difficult to find. They're relatively short-lived. They're very small. And the larvae, by the time you find them, usually that plant is pretty severely damaged, and they're one of these insects that feed inside of the plant. You know, they feed kind of under the epidermis, the outer skin of that soybean stem. And so it's difficult to reach them with an insecticide. I believe they've tested the various insecticide seed treatments. I don't know that they've had a lot of success, at least with the, you know, currently available materials. Foliar insecticides haven't really worked. There's a few, I believe, granular insecticides that they've had some success with, but they're things like older carbamate and organophosphate materials that we're not really used to using in soybean, and we would just as soon not use in soybean. I'm thinking one of them was maybe Furadan or something like that, you know, pretty toxic materials. So that's kind of where we're at on that species. They've had a difficult time controlling it, which is bad news, but the good news is it's sort of the area where it's causing serious damage is the same area that was causing serious damage 2 or 3 years ago.
What's the timing of that life cycle? When are they laying eggs and hatching and feeding?
My understanding is those adults tend to be coming out. We usually get an alert in June, and that's when they come out. I'm not sure how many generations per year they go through, but I think it's perhaps a couple. And then those larvae will develop on the plants sort of throughout the growing season. When the damage becomes evident, tends to be later in the season, as those plants that are most heavily affected by it, they die prematurely. And so the initial symptom sort of resembles like an SDS or something like that, where you have dead or dying plants out there, especially on the edges of the field, seems to be where it tends to occur first. And then you go and look at those plants and peel back the skin, and you find these little orange fly larvae inside of them.
Are those eggs being laid actually on the plant, or are they laid in the soil and then they crawl to the plant when they hatch, or how are they getting there?
Yeah, my understanding is they're laid in the plant.
In the plant, okay.
Yeah.
So they're actually...
I think they pupate in the soil, but I believe the eggs are laid in the plant.
Okay. Interesting. Well, yeah, definitely something we want to keep an eye on, and good to hear that it's, you know, not been expanding to any large degree as of yet, but definitely something we'll want to keep our eyes and ears peeled for. So, anything else, Nick, on the insect front that, you know, we need to be thinking about right now?
Oh, you know, at this time of year, it's always kind of an adventure. We never really know what's going to happen until it does. Certainly one of the, in terms of early issues that we'll see, we already talked about cutworm and armyworm. I'd throw beanleaf beetle in with that. You know, if we get, especially if we get into a situation where we have some soybean fields emerging early and then it cools off or gets wet and we don't have a lot planted, those few isolated fields can get pretty heavy numbers of beanleaf beetle early. That tends to be largely cosmetic unless they're carrying bean pod model virus. You can get some yield effects from that. But that kind of is the, you know, the first pest that we tend to see as the season kicks off.
Okay. And we'll, you know, we'll kind of see how things progress. We might ask you to come back once we kind of get into mid-season and see what things are looking like in terms of aphids or Japanese beetles, some of those other things that we think about later on. So.
Yeah, sure thing.
All right. Well, Nick, once again, appreciate you taking the time, share your insight with us. All, you know, great information as always. Nick Sider, Research Assistant Professor, Field Crop Entomology with the University of Illinois. Thanks again, Nick.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everyone for listening, and we will see you next time on the next episode of Hertz Ag Talk. Thank you.